Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is Bamidbar in the wilderness. It is Numbers 1 from verse 1 to Numbers 4 verse 20. The Haftarah is Hosea chapter 1 verses 10 and 11 and Hosea chapter 2 verses 1 to 22. The Brit Hadashah is Romans chapter 9 verses 22 to 33. Before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech HaOlam. Blessed are you, O Lord my God, King of the universe. You are the creator of all things. We thank you and praise you for your Shabbats, for your feasts, for your Torah, for everything that you do for us, that you have provided for us. Abba, I pray that you will be with your people who are keeping the Shabbat and Shavuot this weekend, and just let my words fall by the wayside and let your words flourish and bless your people in Yeshua's name. Amen. Okay, this week is kind of a double portion, actually. Bamidbar is the first book of the first Torah portion of the book of Bamidbar, or Numbers. But we also are celebrating Shavuot, so I'm going to be talking about both intermittently throughout this Torah portion, throughout this teaching. I want to start talking about Shavuot because I want us to understand about the bread. We have been through unleavened bread, and now we're in Shavuot, and both of them have a lot to do with bread. Unleavened bread, of course, is a different kind of bread than the bread we celebrate with at Shavuot. The unleavened bread is dead bread. You can't live on unleavened bread. It's harmful to your health. The leavened bread is living bread. Now, when we go through Passover, we get out all of the bad doctrine, all of the leavening, right? By the time that we get to the 50th day of this season of the spring feasts, by the time we get to Shavuot from the beginning of unleavened bread, actually we start counting from the Feast of First Fruits, but by the time we get all the way to Shavuot, we should be full of correct doctrine. The leavened bread of Yeshua is correct doctrine. The leavened bread of mankind, of the Pharisees, of people like me, could be full of bad doctrine. That's why I always tell you to verify everything I say. Don't just listen to what I say. Go to the scriptures, read the scriptures, ask the Lord to show you if I have said anything that is not correct. And in fact, it's why I pray that the Lord will just let my words fall by the wayside, because my words are bound to be mixed up, you know, with the knowledge of good and evil and with the truth, you see. And so that's the way it is with all teachers. At least that's the way it is with all teachers now. It didn't used to be that way necessarily. We have the prophets who we would never say that their words had leavening in them, the false doctrine in them, you see. But today, things have just progressively gotten worse on the earth, and to the point where people are calling evil good and good evil, as Isaiah said. And so we need to learn the difference between good leaven and bad leaven, because the doctrine of the Lord is good and healthy leaven for your spirit. It feeds your soul. The leaven of the Pharisees, the leaven of the false Christian teachers, and even the false Hebrew roots teachers, that's bad leaven. We don't want that. So unleavened bread is dead bread. The leavened bread is living bread. We go from death to life. That's what this means. We're going from death to life. Leavened bread also is associated with resurrection. Now, we human beings don't think of going from death to life, we always think about going from life to death. I'm born and then I die. You know, birth to death. This is because we don't understand what the scriptures say, and we also weren't really conscious when we were conceived, because before the moment of our conception, we were dead. We were literally brought to life from the time of our conception in this human body. So we literally did go from death to life. We were like a seed, and seeds go from death to life. And the resurrection then is pictured in the spring feasts. There is a death, the death of our flesh, the death of false doctrine, and the giving of ourselves as first fruits, and then counting the days to our Jubilee, which is the day of Shavuot, represents the Jubilee, at which time we will be resurrected. So at Nisan 1, it is if we were dead. It's like we were dead. And then we come out of Egypt through the blood of the Lamb, and we're washed off by the water, the Red Sea, of that birthing process. And we do that by being baptized. And so just like Yeshua, who died and was raised and became the first fruits of many, we go through that process every year, see? The unleavened bread represents our own going from death and infancy to full stature as a member of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh's kingdom over that 50-day period from first fruits to Shavuot. So we go from death to life. We go toward the resurrection. Shavuot is a rehearsal for the resurrection when we have the proper leavened bread, which is full of life, full of truth, and correct doctrine, see, because that belongs to the Lord. So the Lord has been teaching us about resurrection from the beginning. This is not new in the New Testament. From Shavuot to the next feast of unleavened bread, then we get to experience life. From there, we get defiled. Stuff happens to us. We have troubles in our lives. Sometimes we have to go into debt, and we lose our stuff. That's why we need to have our stuff restored to us, right? We need to get our debts paid, and we need to become no longer somebody's bond servant or slave, and we have to have the Lord to restore our land to us and so forth, because stuff happens to us. So that's why we look for our Messiah at the Feast of Trumpets. But we can't get rescued as a nation until we get cleansed at the Day of Atonement, because the Day of Atonement has to do with cleansing an unclean people who have been through the mire of life already, because, you know, when you've been through the mire of life and your flesh is all messed up, as we all are, we cannot inherit the kingdom at the Feast of Tabernacles. So we look for the Messiah at the Feast of Trumpets. When he comes, he starts cleaning up things. At the Day of Atonement, his people get cleaned up, and then we inherit the kingdom at the Feast of Tabernacles. So you can see that the feasts in the spring and in the fall are rehearsals for actual spiritual realities that are inside of us, and they are prophecies of things that have either already been at least partially fulfilled, into the future, the things that will be completely fulfilled. So we count the 50 days by counting the Omer. And those 50 days are a prophecy of the Jubilees, the times when we are set free, when our debts are paid, when our land is returned to us. And mankind gets to be set free 120 times. The Lord said to Noah, I'm going to give mankind 120 years. That's the length of his life. Well, some people don't agree with this. I think that that's a prophecy of the Jubilees, because 50 times 120 equals 6,000. If that rings a bell with you, then, you know, you might be on the same page with me. Then, after these 120 times have been fulfilled, the Messiah comes to liberate the earth from the enemy of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which is Hasatan. He liberates the earth for good. Now, after that, I don't know if we're going to celebrate any more jubilees, but I know that at this cycle of time, we get 120 of those jubilees. So what happens now, we're going to move into the away from Shavuot for a minute, and we're going to move into the Bamidbar Torah portion. We're going to talk about the census, and we're going to talk about being counted. In this Torah portion, we're going to find out how important it is to be counted among those who have been celebrating the feasts. The feasts have a lot to do with the bride. We're going to find out later on in this Torah portion. So, the census is being taken to see who is the bride, who is going to be in the kingdom. And as I've said before, don't be confused. Not everybody in the kingdom is going to be the bride. There'll be, you know, every family, not everybody in the family is the bride. You see, there's the mom and dad. Mom is the bride, and then there are other people in the family. That's the way it's going to be in the kingdom. So don't think that I'm saying if you're not the bride, you're not in the kingdom. That's not what I'm saying at all. The feasts have a lot to do with everybody, but they do have a much more significance to the bride, and I'm going to show you that a little bit later on. So in this Torah portion, the Lord is beginning to set up the governmental structure of this new nation. And he's going to start with the military first, and then he's going to count the servers of Aaron, the high priest, which are the Levites. So the Lord presents these very meticulous instructions to us, and it seems like he's repeating himself and repeating himself and repeating himself, but that is because he's showing us that there is a legality to this and there is order to this. You have to be counted and you have to be named. And so, you know, in the kingdom, we're going to each get a new name. And when we get our new name, I believe, and there's no scriptural reference for this, it's just that I happen to believe this. And I don't really know why at the moment, because it's just something that has occurred to me. That when we get our new name, it's going to count. He's going to count us. Because if we look in this Torah portion, he counts the people by name. Now, he counts them by families, of course, and probably in the kingdom it'll be the same way. You know, whatever gate you go through, you know, that tribe, that'll be how you get counted. But whoever does the counting, whoever goes up to the table there in Numbers 1:1 and says, you know, this is my family, they give all the names. So I believe that when we get our new name, that's when we're going to be counted as being in the kingdom. Let's go to Numbers 1:1. And the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tabernacle of the congregation, on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they were come out of the land of Egypt. So they were being counted on the first day of the second month. What this tells us is that they've completed one complete year in the wilderness around Sinai. Now, what he wants to do here is he wants to know everyone that is among the congregation. Verse 2, take the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel after their families by the house of their fathers and with the number of their names. See, he's counting the number of names of every male by their polls. You see, I think that they probably listed the names as well. Even all they that were numbered were 600,000 and 3,550. So this is the number of men from 20 years old and upward who can serve in the military. This is where we get the idea that there's probably somewhere between 2 and 3 million people that came out of Egypt, because there are a whole bunch of people that are not being counted in this census, because this is the men who are building being counted here. Verse 47, but the Levites after the tribe of their fathers were not numbered among them. And as I said, the Lord in chapter 1 repeats himself with each tribe. He says exactly the same words with each tribe. And so why does he do that? Well, he is giving each tribe its legal status in the kingdom. So what he does is he lists the name of the tribe. Obviously, the original 12 men, the sons of Jacob, are no longer alive, but he lists the father of that tribe, and then the children come that are alive there at Mount Sinai, who are of that tribe, are listed. And so we see that he is giving them their pedigree, their legal position. He is creating now an army for this nation. And each tribe is going to function under its own particular flag, under its own particular standard. Now, if the Lord didn't name and do it this way, then there would be no legal precedent for saying that someone from the tribe of Gad is part of the nation, or that someone from the tribe of Naphtali is part of the nation. You see what I'm saying? Have you ever sat in a court proceeding? They go through all this boring stuff too. And it's the same thing. It's about the legality of it. The Lord, we're just literally getting the legality of who belongs in the nation. And that each one of us in the end of days is going to belong to one of these tribes. We're not going to be, you know, going through a Baptist gate or a Catholic gate or a Presbyterian gate or a Nazarene gate. No, the gates are going to be of the tribes, and the tribes, the tribal affiliations are going to be very important in the kingdom. Now in Numbers 1:48, we start to see where the Lord said that you shall not number the tribe of Levi, neither take the sum of them among the children of Israel. But you shall appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of testimony and over all the vessels thereof and over all things that belong to it. They shall bear the tabernacle and all the vessels thereof, and they shall minister to it and shall encamp around about the tabernacle. And when the tabernacle sets forth, the Levites shall take it down. And when the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levites shall set it up, and the stranger that comes near shall be put to death. And the children of Israel shall pitch their tents, every man by his own camp and every man by his own standard throughout their hosts. So, we see here that the Levites are not going to be numbered. We're going to find out that in this Torah portion that the Lord actually gave the Levites to Aaron as a gift. In verse 53 it says, but the Levites shall pitch around the tabernacle of testimony, that there be no wrath upon the congregation of the guard of the children of Israel, and the Levites shall keep the charge of the tabernacle of testimony. So here we get an idea in these few verses what the Levites are going to be doing, and one of their jobs is to protect the tabernacle from the people, and the people from the tabernacle. You would get the impression, because the Levites are not being numbered as military people, that they probably wouldn't be doing much fighting. Well, their job is to guard the tabernacle. And again, guarding the tabernacle protects the tabernacle from the people, and it protects the people from the tabernacle, because if the people get too close to the tabernacle, if they're not clean, or if they come in to do something evil like Korah did, or like later on Zimri and Cosby did, then, you know, somebody's going to die. So their job is to guard the tabernacle. And in, I think it's chapter 25, we see that Zimri and Cosby go into the tabernacle, and they're going to treat the tabernacle like the Moabites and the Midianites treated their deity, which was, you know, to do the prostitute thing and, you know, have sexual relations like they would if they were before any other demon deity. And the job of those Levites was to keep them out of there and to stop them from doing that. But it wasn't a Levite who stopped them. It was Phinehas, or Pinchas was his Hebrew name, and he is the son, grandson rather, of Aaron, and he is the one that goes in there and kills those two. Well, this is the first time, really, that we've seen anybody from the general population to breach through the boundary of the Levites around the tabernacle, and we see what happens, and now we know, we get a sense of what they were supposed to do that they actually failed to do properly, and probably, you know, they learned from that. In chapter 17, we learn about Korah, but Korah was a Levite, and he tried to usurp Aaron and Moses' authority. So it's not quite the same thing as what happened with Zimri and Cosby. Because while Zimri and Cosby were encroaching on the tabernacle, Korah was encroaching on the authority of Moses and Aaron. And so it's a little bit different situation there. But we're going to get object lessons here in the book of Numbers about what it means for the Levites to protect and defend both the people and the tabernacle. They are they're that line, that picket line, if you wanted to go that direction, that you just don't cross that line. And so it isn't that the Levites were not military men or that they couldn't fight. It's that the Levites fighting had a different purpose than the other tribes with their fighting. So now let's go to chapter 3, verse 6, where it says, "Bring the tribe of Levi near and present them before Aaron the priest, so they may minister to him. And they shall keep his charge and the charge of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of the congregation to do the service of the tabernacle." So the line of Aaron is a Levite, but that particular line, and it starts with Aaron, not with Levi, that particular line ministers to the Lord, but all the other Levites are given the charge of the tabernacle to do the service of the tabernacle and to minister in the way that Aaron will guide them to minister in their capacity. So they're very important, these Levites. We're going to jump down to verse 12, and we're going to pay attention because this is very important. Numbers 3:12 says, "And I, behold, I have taken the Levites from among the sons of Israel instead of all the firstborn that opened the womb from the sons of Israel. Therefore the Levites shall be mine." This is one of the places that is very significant in showing how the Lord develops his nation and uses those things that are not a forever thing to make changes in the way that he administrates his government. What do I mean by that? Well, there are things that he says are forever. Like, you know, the priesthood, that's forever. What he gave to Aaron, that's forever. The Sabbath, that's forever. Our salvation, our deliverance is forever. The covenant is forever. The firstborns are not a forever thing. He can make changes to that, see? The place where he puts his presence, that is going to change. That will go from being in the tabernacle to being in Gilgal, and then it's going to be in Shiloh, and then it'll be in Nob, and then it'll be in Gibeon. His presence goes with the tabernacle, so wherever the tabernacle goes, that's where his presence is. But he doesn't put his name forever on any place until it gets to Jerusalem. So what I'm telling you is that the Lord works in processes. And the things that are not forever can change. He can change them until they become a forever thing. For instance, you and I, when we are born again, we become automatically a firstborn. I've explained this before, that we are a nation of firstborns. Yeshua was the firstborn of many. So we are firstborns. Now, we're not going to be a forever firstborn until we get our new bodies at the time of the resurrection. Until that time, we're just a firstborn. But after the resurrection, we will be a firstborn immortal, or an immortal firstborn. You see, there's a progress, a process, and changes can be made, except to those things that the Lord says is forever. The feasts, for instance, those are forever. His dietary laws, those are not going to change. There are things that he says will not change. They're forever. But the firstborn, this firstborn situation is very important, because up to now, the firstborns did represent the family before the Lord. But right here in Numbers 3:12 is where the Lord is making the change from the firstborns representing the family to now individuals represent themselves. The firstborns represented the family before the Lord. That changes with the ordination of the line of Aaron and the induction of the Levites into the service of the tabernacle. No more does the firstborn represent the family before the Lord. Now, individuals of each family come to the tabernacle to appear before the Lord. This does not, however, do away with your tribal affiliation. You are still a member of whatever tribe you're in. This is dealing with the spiritual authority of the firstborn in each family unit. In other words, the right of the firstborn blessing has transferred from the firstborn to the Levites. Are you seeing that? The firstborn blessing is going to be on the heads of the Levites now. Levi is going to carry that blessing on his shoulder. And this move away from corporate deliverance to a relationship with each individual, or individual deliverance, is going to be a theme that will progress now throughout Scripture and will be fully implemented with the sacrifice of Yeshua. This is why you and I can't claim, well, my granddad, you know, he was saved, and so I can just go out here and live my life the way I want to, because my ancestor, you know, had a relationship with the Lord, and that is all I need to do. No, now you have to do a spiritual relationship with Yeshua. So we get away from the family representation. Now, regarding this, individuals are expected to appear 3 times a year for Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot. A firstborn can no longer represent the entire family, because each household within the family group and the tribe must assemble for the appointed times. As I said before, the right of the firstborn, or the firstborn blessing, that birthright aspect that authorized them to represent the entire family, was subjugated to the Levites. So from now on, everyone is to do and appear, not just the firstborns. So what happens is this. In Exodus 23, verse 17, it says, 3 times in the year all your males shall appear before the Lord, not just the firstborns. This is very important, because the Lord is setting up individual relationships with his people. He's got all your names now. He listed all your names there, actually of the fighting men. He listed all those names. And so he's progressing through getting a relationship with everybody. Deuteronomy 16:16. 3 times in a year shall all your males appear before Jehovah your God in the place which he shall choose, in the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and in the Feast of Tabernacles. And then in Deuteronomy 12:10 through 12, it says, "But when you go over Jordan and live in the land which Jehovah your God gives you to inherit, and he gives you a rest from all your enemies round, so that you live in safety, then there shall be a place which Jehovah your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. There you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and the heave offering of your hand, and all your choice vows which you vow to Jehovah. And you shall rejoice before Jehovah your God, you, your sons, your daughters, your men servants, your female servants, and the Levite that is within your gates." Deuteronomy 16:11. "And you shall rejoice before Jehovah your God, you, your son, your daughter, your male servant, your slave girl, the Levite within your gate, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, those among you in the place which Jehovah your God has chosen to place his name there." See, the list is getting longer now. Did you notice that? In Deuteronomy 12:12, he lists you, your sons, your daughters, your men servants, your female servants, and the Levite. In 16:11, he mentions the widow, the fatherless, and the stranger. You see, he's now, again, these are indications of the Lord progressing his people through a process so that they take on themselves more and more of their own responsibility for their own salvation, for their own personal relationship with the Lord. You see, he's very patient with us. This was going on 3,500 years ago, what we're reading about now in Bamidbar. This counting was going on about, probably not exactly 3,500 years ago, but roughly in that time frame. He has progressed his people from a corporate structure to an individual structure. This is very important because he's not going to deliver everybody who is physically a Hebrew. Paul said that unless your heart is circumcised, and unless you, and we know that unless you, have a personal relationship with Jehovah, you've got to have certain things in your life that indicate that you actually are in covenant. I mean, there are a lot of Jews that live in Jerusalem and that live in Tel Aviv and all over the land who are secular. They're Hebrews, they're Jews, but unless they have a personal relationship with the Lord, they're not going to be delivered, because the next great deliverance, the greater Exodus, is not a corporate deliverance. It's an individual deliverance of, a whole bunch of people who have said yes to the Lord individually, not as a nation, not as a corporate entity. And so what the Lord is telling us here with these three pilgrimage feasts is that we are to assemble in the place where the Lord's name is. So everyone in the family, including the strangers, the servants, the widows, everyone is to assemble, but the males of each family unit are to appear to the Lord. They are to go actually to the place where, he's going to build a structure, and they will go there and they will appear to the Lord and they will do business with the Lord there. Everybody else is just kind of hanging out in Jerusalem, or when the tabernacle sat at Shiloh for 369 years, everybody just kind of hung out in Shiloh, and the whole family went, and we read about this in 1 Samuel, where Hannah wanted to have a child, and her husband took the family to do that, to Shiloh, to do what they were supposed to do, Elkanah, her husband. And so we find out that they were going up to Shiloh for the feasts there, you see. So he took everybody, they all assembled, but he went to do his business with the Lord. However, it's kind of like a conference, Dad has a business and he's going to go to this conference, and all the men are required to go to say, a certain meeting. The wife and the kids, well, you know, they can go, they can attend that meeting, but they don't have to. The men have to. But they all go to the conference. You see, it's that kind of idea. Why am I bringing this up? Well, it's because there is this notion that the firstborn might have been able to do this, to go and represent the family at Jerusalem or to Shiloh or wherever the tabernacle was at the time, but later on it became Jerusalem because the Lord took us through the process of going from a tabernacle that was temporary and movable, portable, to a structure that is permanent and where his name is in a city where his name is, where, you know, there's a permanent structure in that place, in that city, that, you know, we're not going to do this by firstborns anymore. The firstborns are now the Levites. They represent you and I in this structure. And so we all are required now to assemble, not just the firstborns. So what is the connection between this census taking thing that's going on here in Bamidbar and the feasts of the Lord? Why am I connecting them? Well, you know, the eyes and the heart of the Lord are in Jerusalem. Solomon sanctified the temple in Jerusalem and put the Lord's name in Jerusalem. And the Lord said, yes, and I will keep my name there forever. Jerusalem became a forever thing. And so when you go up to the pilgrimage feast three times a year, guess what you're doing? You're actually participating in a census. He's counting you. This is a recreation of what happens at this census that we're learning about in this Torah portion. The Lord is counting who is with him. Why does this happen three times a year? I mean, you would think like once a year. I mean, you know, in the United States, they do the census every 10 years. Why does the Lord want to see us assemble and have us present ourselves to him three times a year? Well, I can tell you why. It's because he is a good king. He is a better king than any king on the earth. He wants to keep a detailed tracking record of everyone in his kingdom. He wants to know our military strength. He wants to know who can and cannot serve. He wants to know who is in line with his agendas for the kingdom of Israel, for the land and for the people and so forth. So, doing the feasts, when he says, how he says, and where he says is important. Even though the temple is in ruins, because as I said, his eyes and his heart and his presence is still there because of the covenant that was made between the Lord and Jerusalem and Temple Mount when Solomon dedicated the temple as the Lord's dwelling place. Now, his house may be in ruins, but he is still there, and he wants us to come to see him and to visit him so that we can be counted. So the requirement is for everyone to assemble in Jerusalem, but the men are required to go to Temple Mount. Women and children are not required, but they are permitted to go to Temple Mount. They're required to go to Jerusalem, but not to Temple Mount. So that's an example of the conference, you know, that I gave, the conference example. The wives must go to Jerusalem, the servants and the strangers and the widows even go to Jerusalem, but the men go up to Temple Mount to present themselves to the Lord. So when we do these feasts, I said that they're like the Lord. He, you know, his eyes are there to see us. They're like he is taking a census and counting us. So what are we actually doing when we assemble in Jerusalem? Well, when we assemble there, we are affirming at Passover that we are part of the covenant. When we assemble there for Shavuot, we are affirming our trust in the Lord that he keeps faith with those who sleep in the dust. And in other words, what we're saying to him is, please include me in the resurrection. And at Sukkot, we are rehearsing for our wedding. You know, a couple who's going to get married do not always live where the wedding will take place, but they always go to the place they selected for the wedding to rehearse the wedding. You know, they actually go to the place where they're going to be married to rehearse the wedding. Our wedding, this is the point that I was trying to make earlier about how important this is for the bride. Our wedding will take place in Jerusalem. This is why we go there every year, to rehearse getting married to Yeshua. So there he is, the groom, awaiting his bride to come to Jerusalem every year to rehearse, every year to confirm the covenant, every year to raise your hand there and say, please include me in the resurrection. You see, this process of ingathering has been a long one. So far, as since the time of Yeshua, it's been 2,000 years. From the time of when Jeroboam split off from the house of Jacob, it's been over 2,700 years. But human beings don't live that long. So it's important for us to assemble individually and to appear in Jerusalem and to appear at Temple Mount, especially for the men, although I love to go to the Western Wall and to go to Temple Mount and to be there. It's important for us to do these things while we still can. While we can have a record of it, that we were there for those times when we can still be counted before we die. Now, you're probably thinking, you know, it's probably unnecessary for me to bring this all up about the feasts, because we've been learning about the feasts. We're going to learn more about the feasts. But you see, this is Shavuot, and I'm getting ready to go up for the feast, and I'm so blessed to be able to do that. And I want to bring this message in Bamidbar about the feast, because we're in the season of Shavuot. We're getting ready to end the spring feast season, you see. I will give you my little personal testimony here, that I've had a change of understanding. I used to say, you know, do the feasts where you are, go to Sukkot, you know, there, wherever you want to go to Sukkot, out here, and rehearse out here in the diaspora. Because I didn't understand. And if you've been listening to my Torah portions long enough, you probably know this progression, because I've talked about it. That somebody one day called and said, you want to go to Israel? Yes. So they paid for my trip to Israel. While I was in Israel, I went to Jordan, and I got an epiphany. Oh my goodness, this is the wilderness where the woman is going to go. I come back to the United States, and the Lord gives me the teaching, the time to flee. He's preparing his people for that time, whenever it is, when we need to flee. The things that we need to watch for so that we know when to flee. And then all of a sudden, here I find myself, I didn't even really understand that he was moving me out of Babylon and into his land. I didn't understand about that. But here I am. And in 2014, before I went to Sukkot in 2014, I was going to be a speaker at the Sukkot in Oregon. And the Lord started in 2014 telling me that I needed to be at Sukkot in 2015. This was while I was still in the process of preparing to go on the Israel tour with Rico in January of 2015. The Lord is already telling me to be at Sukkot in 2015. So come 2015, guess where I'm at in all this process of going to Israel and going to Jordan, doing the teaching, and then he moving me over here. Guess where I find myself at Sukkot in 2015? In Jerusalem. Now I start to get it, but I didn't quite get it yet. I was getting it. So then I went back to Israel for Hanukkah, because as I've said in other teachings, Hanukkah is for us to keep, and without going into all the reasons why, you can listen to other teachings that I've done about that. Hanukkah is prophetically significant, and it was implemented by the people who had the authority to implement it, and the all the congregation stood up and said, just like at Mount Sinai, we're going to do this thing from year to year. And so just like at Mount Sinai, you and I are now, we have that, it's incumbent upon us to do what they said that they would do at Mount Sinai. Every time the congregation stands up and says we're going to do this thing, it's incumbent on us to do that. And I've taught about that. So I went to Hanukkah, and I went to get the priestly blessing at Hanukkah. I went to get the priestly blessing at Sukkot. And I'm beginning to get a change. I mean, my heart is changing. And I go for Passover, and then it's at Passover when I really get it. We don't get to do these just anywhere. We need to do them at the place of His name. He said His name is in Jerusalem, and it will be there forever. That's what He said. And He said, I want you to do these feasts at the place where I'm going to choose to put my name there. He didn't say go to the temple. He said go to the place where I choose to put my name. The temple, see, this is a two-part command. You assemble there and you do sacrifices. The Lord didn't make it so that all you're doing at the feast is doing sacrifices. There's assemblies that happen there. So part one is assemble there. Part two is bring your sacrifice. You can do this without the temple. You can assemble without the temple because His name is still there. And at Passover is when I got it, when I understood it. I don't know how to impart that to you, but we're in the season of Shavuot. We are ending the spring feasts now, and I can't tell you how blessed it is to go to the place of His name where He's going to take us to get married. I don't know how to convey that to you. But what I do know is it changed my life. Now, I know that most of the Lord's people are in exile. Guess what? He knows that too. It's not always possible for people to go. There's financial considerations. There's health considerations. There's other family considerations. It's sometimes difficult to get there. What I'm telling you is that if you have the means to spend money going someplace for Sukkot, spend the money going to Jerusalem. Don't go and visit, a Sukkot camp in the States or in Italy or in Australia. You know, some people will fly all the way from South Africa and they'll go to some place in the United States. Spend the money to go to the place of His name. And just know that if you can't go, the Lord understands that. He will understand that really well if He knows that you're trying to get there. I can tell you that more and more of our people from the house of Israel are appearing in Jerusalem every year. And to me, this is an indication. It's more indication that the ingathering, the Spirit is moving, that the ingathering is happening. I'm sorry, I have to keep, I'm pausing on this end because I keep choking up here. The ingathering is happening. The Lord is moving His people, and more are coming. And some come once a year. Some come three times a year. Some people send just the Father because they don't have enough money to send everybody. There's a family of 9 or 10 that comes three times a year. These people are not wealthy people, but they come they sacrifice other things in their life in order to be in Jerusalem for all three pilgrimage feasts. Now, nobody's going to condemn anybody. Nobody's going to say you're not the bride or you're not going to be in the kingdom or you're going to hell, at least not out of my mouth, if you don't come. I'm just telling you that I have seen the significance and experienced the change in my life because I have come to Jerusalem for these feasts. And it's a very major, major deal. You've heard me say this before. that there are four levels of understanding: the Peshat, the Remez, the Drash, and the Sod. But I've always said there is that fifth level, and that is the experiential level. It's when you actually experience it. That's when you get it in both your head and your heart. So I'm going to leave it off there. I just hope that you are inspired to try to make it to Jerusalem. And don't think that I'm condemning you if you can't make it to Jerusalem. Because truthfully, in exile, we're all a bunch of slaves. And slaves don't always get to do what they want to do. And so that's why the Lord has to deliver them out of slavery. You see, they have to be brought out of Babylon and so forth. But if you can, you will be more blessed in your life than you can even imagine. And I'll tell you one more thing. Let me tell you this. Hezekiah, after the house of Israel was taken into captivity into Assyria, Hezekiah sent a letter to those who were, you know, the few that were still left in the northern areas. He sent a letter up there and he said, come for Passover. And here's what he said about coming for Passover. In 2 Chronicles 30, verse 9, he says, if you return to the Lord, your relatives and children will receive compassion from those who took them away captive, and they'll return to this land because the Lord is both gracious and compassionate. He will not turn away from you if you return to Him. You see, the Lord's compassion and mercy will be toward our children and our families when we return to Jerusalem for the feasts. So thank you for listening to this Torah portion. I hope that it's been a blessing to you. Give all glory, honor, and praise to the one to whom all glory, honor, and praise belongs, Yeshua Messiah. Shabbat Shalom and Chag Sameach.